Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, March 17th. I'm Ray Graff. Support comes from CHP Berkshires, celebrating 50 years of healthcare, family support, WIC, and food security, serving nearly 30,000 Berkshire residents, primary care, women's health, dental, and more. CHPBerkshires.org. Today, we welcome Dr. Pasquale Passarella, an endocrinologist at Albany Medical Center. Dr. Passarella specializes in treating patients with diabetes and thyroid disorders, as well as other general endocrine system disorders and diseases. If you have a question, call now, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Pasquale Passarella and your calls coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we're joined on this Medical Monday by Dr. Pasquale Passarella, an endocrinologist at Albany Medical Center. Dr. Passarella specializes in treating patients with diabetes and thyroid disorders, as well as other general endocrine system disorders and diseases. He completed a fellowship in endocrinology at Albany Med and a residency in internal medicine at New York Presbyterian Brooklyn Methodist Hospital. He earned his medical degree from St. George's University of Medicine. If you have a question about endocrinology today, 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Pasquale Passarella, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be here.
It's a mystery to me, this whole endocrine system. Why don't we explain to me and maybe a few others as ignorant as I about what the endocrine system does in a nutshell?
Sure. Great question. The endocrine system is the system in the body whereby certain tissues that we call glands release hormones, which are proteins that enter the bloodstream directly from those glands, go to different tissues throughout the body, and essentially tell them to do things. For example, the thyroid gland, which is present in the neck, produces thyroid hormone, which does things like control the body's metabolism, the metabolic rate, and also increases sensitivity to adrenaline, controlling the heart rate and the body's temperature.
So what causes and what regulates the release of hormones? Does the nervous system, does the brain do this, or is this some physical or chemical reaction that regulates the flow of hormones?
There's several different things that regulate the different hormone systems in the body. It does start in many of the different endocrine systems from the brain. The pituitary gland in the brain, which is kind of at the base of the brain toward near the center, it's about the size of a walnut or so, that is what we call the master gland. It produces several different hormones that tell other glands in the body, like the thyroid gland that I mentioned, or the adrenal glands, or even the testes in men, the ovaries in women, to produce their and hormones. But hormone release is also controlled by feedback systems in your body that help to kind of regulate homeostasis or the natural state of things. So for one example, one of the hormones that is present from a gland in the neck, the parathyroid gland, controls the body's calcium levels. And so if calcium levels in the blood start to drop, that stimulates the parathyroid gland to produce parathyroid hormone, which then raises the calcium. So it's all kind of a back and forth ebb and flow to keep things under good control.
What an amazing, exquisite, complicated system the human body is. When someone has diabetes, what is going wrong?
So there's a couple different things that can go wrong, but at the end of the day, it is a deficiency in either the amount of insulin being released or in the action of insulin. And insulin is the major hormone that mediates or controls the blood sugar levels. When we are fasting, for example, when we go to bed, we don't eat anything else, the reason our sugar doesn't drop overnight is insulin levels decrease, and then other hormones like glucagon raise the blood sugar level. And then when we eat food, and then we have the sugar from the carbohydrates or just pure sugar that we're eating entering the bloodstream, insulin is released, which then lets the body store that sugar or put it to use as energy. And those two things regulate the blood sugar. So for people who have, for example, type 1 diabetes, that is generally due to an autoimmune process where the own body's immune system attacks and damages the cells in the pancreas that make insulin, resulting in deficiency in insulin. Or there's type 2 diabetes, which is the more common cause, that is due to what we call resistance to insulin. The body's just not responding to insulin as well as it used to.
We're joined today by Dr. Pasquale Passarella, an endocrinologist at Albany Medical Center. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. What, in fact, is insulin resistance?
So there are several different factors that can cause insulin resistance. A major factor is your genetic makeup. Some people just are more likely to develop insulin resistance and diabetes, and that's why it often tends to run in families, that type 2 diabetes. But it's also very closely tied to weight. The more we weigh, the more likely we are to become resistant to the action of insulin. But it's not a universal thing. Two different people who are the same amount of weight, you know, overweight, or obese or otherwise, one person may develop diabetes where another person does not.
So when you have insulin resistance and you're type 2 diabetic, you're producing insulin, but for some reason you're resistant to it. What makes you I know you said overweight, but what is the chemical thing that's going on that makes someone insulin resistant?
So it has to do with the insulin receptors, right? So insulin is made by the what we call the islet cells in the pancreas, enters the bloodstream, and then gets picked up by the cells in the liver or the fat or the muscle that help us to kind of metabolize, break down, use, and store sugar. And as we have those genetic changes I mentioned or increase in weight, those receptors become resistant and they don't respond to insulin the way they used to. The same amount of insulin doesn't go as far in lowering the blood sugar levels.
But people who lose large amounts of weight can in some ways roll back the diabetes. Does that mean the insulin resistance becomes less?
Absolutely correct. Yeah. So for those people who develop insulin resistance associated with excess weight, there is a lot of evidence out there that losing that excess weight, even starting at 5% of your excess weight, but the more you do, the more impact we see, that weight loss can reduce the insulin resistance and therefore help control blood sugar levels better and also decrease the amount of medications people need.
Okay. And I'm glad you brought up medications. Obviously, when you are a type 1 diabetic or a type 2 diabetic that has progressed pretty far, there will be insulin shots involved. But many people I know who are not there yet or ever take things like metformin. And what do those things do?
When it comes to management, treatment of diabetes, yeah, there's a lot of different medications out there. And nowadays, the options are so much broader than they were even 5 years ago, but longer. So insulin is what we think about traditionally. And those people who have type 1 diabetes, where they make no insulin or virtually no insulin, they are insulin dependent. They require insulin treatment. People with type 2 diabetes who have insulin resistance, they can be treated with insulin. They're resistant to their own body's insulin, so they need an addition, more insulin to help control them better. But then there are those other medications. You mentioned metformin. That's one of the most common medications we prescribe for type 2 diabetes nowadays. And it works by making the body more sensitive to insulin. It literally directly impacts the underlying cause of type 2 diabetes to increase sensitivity, i.e. reduce resistance to insulin.
We're joined by Dr. Pasquale Passarella today. For some reason, this is a tongue twister for me, so I'm sure I'm going to screw your name
no
up
problem.
At least 12 times today. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Why don't we grab an email or two before the first break, and then we'll hit the phones. This one's from Peter. Why is pancreatic cancer so invasive and so deadly?
So that is a really fantastic question. Pancreatic cancer is not actually a condition managed by endocrinology, though it does have endocrine impact. You know, when it comes to various different types of cancers, they have a tendency to behave a certain way, and cancer develops when cells kind of grow and develop in a way that they shouldn't. They become more aggressive. They multiply much more than they should and spread in ways that they should not. The normal defense mechanisms, like your own immune system, become less effective at dealing with these because they learn ways to escape those defense mechanisms. And pancreatic cancer, the type that you're thinking of, does tend to be very aggressive and unfortunately have very poor outcomes. But there are different types of pancreatic cancer that don't necessarily behave the same way.
All right, one more email, and then we'll hit the break, and then we'll hit the phones, and we'll, of course, go back to the email later. The number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Bob writes, oh, boy, there's some medical, there's some medication names in here that I'm about to butcher. So
good luck.
Enjoy. Synthroid and levothyroxine the same? My PCP describes Synthroid and my endocrinologist prescribed levothyroxine. What's the difference?
This is a super common question I get asked all the time, so I'm glad I get to talk about it a little bit. By the way, your pronunciation, perfect.
Well, you see.
So Synthroid and levothyroxine are, in a sense, the same drug. Levothyroxine is the generic term for synthetic thyroid hormone. So that is the medication you take if you have an underactive thyroid, or what we call hypothyroidism. And it is just the thyroid hormone that your thyroid would make. So you're taking it as a replacement. Synthroid is one of the brands of levothyroxine. So you have generic levothyroxine and then brand name Synthroid, which is also levothyroxine, but made from one specific company. They are the same drug. They're dosed one-to-one. So if you're on 50 micrograms of levothyroxine, you'll be on 50 micrograms of Synthroid. But the reason some people prefer Synthroid, or some doctors prefer Synthroid, is that when you're getting it from one specific source, one specific company, the doses tend to be more stable from dose to dose. It's more consistent. That's the better word for it. Whereas the generics are made by a multitude of different companies. And if your pharmacy happens to get a batch from company A this month and then next month company B, there can be slight differences in what is in it in terms of the inactive ingredients. And it can result in very slight, sometimes, not always, but very slight fluctuations in the dosage. So sometimes you may need a little bit more versus a little bit less of the dose that you happen to receive. And so when people take Synthroid, things tend to be a little bit more consistent. But the downside is that because it's branded, it's more the Synthroid is a brand name medication. It's a little bit more expensive, and insurances may not cover it. So you may not be able to get it for the same price.
We're joined by Dr. Pasquale Passarella from Albany Medical Center. It's Endocrinology Today on the program. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll check the, we'll hit the phones in a moment. First, a little Zappa, a little underwriting. We'll put them together. Fox Pop on WAMC. It's Medical Monday, Endocrinology Today with Dr. Pasquale Passarelli. Big Zappa fan, Doc?
Not particularly.
No, that was Son of Mr. Green Jeans. But jeans spelled like your jeans. G-E-N-E-S.
I like it.
N-E-S. Yeah, very, very, very good. From Hot Rats, if you want to pick up the album.
I'll look it up.
So anyway, what do you say we hit the phones, all right? Here we go. Let's go to New York City. Greg, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me right?
Yep, go ahead.
Oh, first of all, happy St. Patrick's Day, Dr. Passarelli.
Thank you so much. You know, I am part Irish, despite my name.
Oh, very good. I'm calling about my condition, which came upon me. I'm in my mid-60s, though still a child. I was diagnosed with hypothyroidism just a couple of years ago. Really knocked me for a loop. So I'm on levothyroxine. Synthroid, whichever. I got the generic prescription. And I've since come to a doctor in New York to, I just had my blood work taken. My guy upstate never once mentioned any vitamin deficiencies, never looked for any vitamin deficiencies. I'm just wondering if there's another approach to treating it besides Synthroid. Anything else that could be added or subtracted to my regimen?
So the mainstay of treatment, the primary treatment for thyroid, for hypothyroidism and underactive thyroid, is some form of thyroid hormone replacement, primarily the levothyroxine that you're taking. What the underlying issue is, your thyroid, for one reason or another, is just not making enough of that hormone. Unfortunately, this has been looked into. They have done studies to look at this. There's no dietary vitamin or mineral deficiency or dietary deficiency that has been shown to really impact or treat hypothyroidism. The one thing I will add to this, though, your thyroid does require iodine in order to make thyroid hormone. So people who are iodine deficient may develop thyroid issues that may improve with thyroid, with iodine supplementation. But that being said, in general, the American diet is iodine sufficient. And that's because many, many years ago, when iodine deficiency was a lot more common, they started supplementing, fortifying iodine into salt. So you'll always see when you buy those canisters of salt in the grocery store, iodized salt. And that was because of iodine deficiency. So anytime you use those standard table salts, or anytime you buy food from the store that has salt added, it has that iodine in it. So we're getting enough through that. Those people who only use things like kosher salt, sea salt, that don't have iodine added, there is a possibility you could have iodine deficiency. But because the U.S. diet in general has sufficient amounts of iodine, the American Thyroid Association does not recommend iodine supplements. And the reason for that is, too much of a good thing is a bad thing. If you take too much iodine, that also can suppress your thyroid, and that can make hypothyroidism worse.
Wow.
So for most people, you don't need to add any iodine, so long as you're not, you know, avoiding iodine.
All right, Greg, thanks a lot for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. Looping back on something you said in the early part of the show, you mentioned the thyroid, and you also mentioned the parathyroid. What's the difference?
So the thyroid is the butterfly-shaped gland that is, it's at the base of the neck. It's very superficial, very close to the surface. When people have an enlarged thyroid, which is what we call a goiter, you can oftentimes see it, but in most cases, you can't see someone's thyroid. That's the gland that produces thyroid hormone, which is what levothyroxine is a synthetic form of, and that is the gland that is responsible for controlling your metabolic rate and things like that. The parathyroids are called that simply because they happen to be next to the thyroids physically or anatomically. There are four parathyroid glands, which are much smaller than the thyroid, two on each side, left and right of your thyroid, kind of behind them in most cases. And those are the glands that produce parathyroid hormone, which controls your calcium levels. Completely different function. Oh. They're not related to each other. They just have similar names because physically they're close to each other.
So they're just neighbors and they, okay.
Exactly.
How unimaginative. The number here is 800-348-2555. 551. Dr. Pasquale Passarella is our guest on Medical Monday. And let's go to Matamoros, and it's Jim. Hello, Jim.
Jewish Tanada Conestatu. That means good afternoon. How are you in Irish?
Oh, I'll be darned.
The question is, how is that a metabolic bone disease related to the hormones?
So that is a very interesting question. Metabolic bone disease is, it's not one specific condition. It is essentially where your bones become weaker and you're more likely to develop broken bones due to a number of factors. In general, throughout our lives, our bones are kind of in a constant state of flux. You have cells in one spot that are building new bones, cells that are breaking down bone, and the net effect of this is bones that are strong but also a little bit flexible. As we age, or if we develop certain metabolic bone disorders, certain medical conditions that impact your bone, it can result in either too much bone breakdown or not enough bone buildup. And then the net effect of this is that your bones become weaker and you're more likely to break down. How this is linked to your hormones is, for starters, the most common way that we see bone loss or bone breakdown nowadays is osteoporosis. Osteoporosis being weakness of the bones, most commonly occurring as we get older, and much, much more common in women as they get older. And when we looked into what the underlying cause for this could be, we found that it was after menopause, that loss of estrogen, that was a major player in why women would lose their bone strength more rapidly and develop fractures as they aged. Estrogen plays an important role in maintaining your bone health, and so the loss is a major reason why you lose bones. There are other hormones that can impact your bones as well. For example, the parathyroid glands that were mentioned just a moment ago, because calcium is the major building block of bone. So if you have a disorder of the parathyroid glands and your calcium levels are either too high or too low, that can result in bone loss as well.
All right, Jim. How do you say goodbye in Irish?
Sloan lat or Sloan up.
All right.
Whether you're coming or going.
All right. Well, same to you. Thank you, Jim. Let's go to Saratoga. Gordon is on. Hello, Gordon.
Hi. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
All right.
Yep. Go ahead.
Okay. Okay. Just a little bit about myself. I'm a type 1 diabetic for the past 32 years, and I have a question for the doctor just about what are the...
Well, we lost you there for a second, Gordo. You want to try it again?
How about now?
Yep. Okay. Start again, my friend.
Yeah. So I'm a diabetic for 32 years, and I wear an insulin pump, an iLet bionic pancreas, and been a member of the DIY community for diabetes for a long time. And I'm just wondering if the doctor has any idea or what are the most promising sort of future therapies that might become available for type 1 diabetics that we can speak of, you know, whether it's combo, glucagon, insulin therapy, technology, or even like future uses of type 1 or type 2 medications off-label for type 1 diabetics. Like Farzesia or anything like that. I'm wondering just what the doctor finds most promising.
Very thought-provoking question. Thank you. So what we have been trying to find, kind of our... what we've been striving for in the management of diabetes since the very, very beginning is to find a way to replicate what the pancreas does. And we've gotten closer and closer and closer as the years have gone by with the iLet that you use, which is one of the newer automated insulin delivery systems, an insulin pump that doesn't just...
I have no inputs.
Yes. Yeah. It's an automated insulin system that automatically adjusts your insulin levels based on blood sugar that is coming from what we call a continuous glucose monitor, a sensor device that's constantly checking your sugar. And so it increases or decreases your insulin level from the pump based on those numbers, therefore taking a lot of the time, effort, stress away from managing the diabetes. But what these pumps cannot do is you mentioned that combination insulin and glucagon in the pump is that when you actually develop lows for whatever reason, you're more active or you thought you were going to eat more than you did, so you gave too much insulin up front, the pumps don't treat low blood sugars. They don't do something like give you sugar or give glucagon. So I know that's something that's been in development for some time, and there's been issues with getting the glucagon a little bit more stable so that it's able to work in a pump. But I think if we can get to a point where we have a pump that can automatically adjust your insulin, control high sugars, but also treat low sugars that requires as little kind of intervention from humans as possible to avoid that human error that we're just all prone to, I think that's going to be the best way to manage type 1 diabetes down the line. We on the, you know, in other realms of managing type 1 diabetes, they have already developed, you know, pancreas transplants or pancreatic islet cell transplants, those cells that produce insulin, that do have some success, but I don't know if we're quite there yet where this can be a universal treatment for people. But as that is more developed and we have more studies, more data, more experience with this, that may be another realm that in the future we can cure type 1 diabetes. And one more thing I'll add, and I know my answer is getting a little long for this question, is we also have developed an infusion treatment for people in early stage type 1 diabetes that has been shown to delay the onset of the autoimmune process that causes the insulin loss of type 1 diabetes. And it's still an early stage treatment, but if we continue developing down that line, we may find a treatment that can prevent people who are at risk from ever developing type 1 diabetes.
Interesting. Now, our caller said he had type 1 diabetes for 32 years. I was always under the impression you're born with this. You can develop type 1 diabetes later in life?
Yeah. So the kind of old paradigm, the old way we thought about diabetes is if you develop diabetes when you're young, you have type 1 diabetes. If you develop diabetes when you're older, you have type 2 diabetes. But the more we have studied diabetes and understand what the underlying cause is, we realize that that's not exactly the case for every person. Type 1 diabetes, as I said before, is an autoimmune process where the body develops antibodies for whatever reason that attack and destroy the cells that make insulin. That process can happen at any age. We do see it most commonly in younger people, not necessarily at birth, actually. Most people develop type 1 diabetes in their adolescence to young adulthood. Huh. That's the most common onset.
Amazing.
There is a type of autoimmune diabetes at birth or genetic type of diabetes that can occur at birth, but that's much, much less common. But you can develop that type 1 autoimmune diabetes at any age, and I've seen people who are newly diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in their 70s, 80s, and older.
Oh, terrific. Another thing to worry about. Let's go
Sorry.
To Mary in Albany. Mary, you're on with Dr. Pasquale Passarella.
Yes, doctor. I have two questions about metformin. I have been on metformin for many, many years, and it works very well with me. My A1C has come down, and I've lost weight. I'm doing well. But my questions are this. It says to take it twice a day with food, and I never know how to space those two pills out in the course of a day when, if I only eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and I don't know how to space out those two pills. And that's my first question. And then my second question is, how much food is required to take with each pill? So maybe you could give me some enlightenment as to how to space those out. I just never know. I don't want to take them too close together either.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I can definitely help with this. So metformin, one of the most common medications we prescribe for type 2 diabetes, the reason that it is recommended to be taken with food is because taking it with food lessens the likelihood of the side effects. The most common side effect with metformin is GI, stomach upset. Some people get bloating, nausea, diarrhea after taking metformin. And so when we looked at it, studies and experience has shown taking it with food tends to prevent that from happening. So what we usually recommend is that you take it either you can take it at the start, during, or right after a meal. And generally, the bigger the meal, the more likely it is to help prevent those side effects. Now, that being said, I know for some people, based on their schedules, they just aren't able to take metformin with meals for whatever reason, or people are doing things like intermittent fasting and they don't eat in the morning. If you can take metformin without eating, and you don't have any side effects, then you can take it that way.
So it'll absorb, okay.
Correct. It's not an issue of absorption. It's an issue of preventing side effects.
Uh-huh.
And then some people will end up taking, just to make it easier to remember, both of their pills together in the morning. And if you can take that and not have side effects, that's okay too, especially if you take the extended release, the longer acting version of the metformin. But for you, you take it twice a day. You can take it with your breakfast and you can take it with your dinner. That's usually how I recommend it.
All right, Mary.
Oh, that's very helpful. I just have never known how far apart to take them, and I never knew I could take the two of them together. I'm a little afraid to do that, though.
Yeah, if this is working for you, then I would continue that way.
All right, thanks a lot. And since you brought up diarrhea, because you can never talk about diarrhea enough on Medical Monday. don't know who wrote this, but does metformin cause diarrhea, which you just said it can? I started taking metformin for A1C being 6.4. It's fine after breakfast, but when I take it after dinner, I've been having diarrhea. And that's from I don't know who.
Yeah, so the diarrhea is one of the more common side effects with metformin, as I mentioned. Not everyone has it. Some people, just when it comes to medications, are more likely to have the side effects, and I feel people who have some underlying, GI, stomach-related issue may be more sensitive to the medication.
Mm-hmm.
It may have to do with the timing with the dinner. If you're taking it after, maybe try taking it before and see if that helps, maybe taking both in the morning with breakfast if you're able to tolerate that. But the other part of it is if you don't tolerate a medication, you shouldn't keep taking it and having the side effects. So you may need to adjust the regimen and discuss that with your doctor.
By the way, it takes me a while to process some information. Did you say earlier something about pancreatic transplants? I have not heard about this.
Yes. Yeah. So we can do pancreatic transplants. They you know, organ transplants in general are, as you would probably imagine, a process, and they do require a lot of clearance, and they require lifelong treatment with immunosuppressive medications to prevent what we call transplant rejection, because a foreign substance in the body, your body's immune system has a tendency to attack that, and that's not something you want with a transplanted organ. So nowadays, the pancreatic transplants tend to be done at the same time as kidney transplants, and that's because people with longstanding diabetes are more likely to develop kidney failure, especially if their diabetes has been uncontrolled. So they can do both of those things at the same time, and they will both require the same kind of immunosuppressive anti-rejection medications. So you are kind of less likely to have rejection or issues or a lot of side effects than doing one and then the other.
All right, let's take a quick break here, and then we'll check the email bag. Dr. Pasquale Passarella joins us from Albany Med today. It's Endocrinology. We'll be right back. This new record, that's Todd Nelson, Space Jelly, from his new album Jazz Americana, here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. Dr. Pasquale Passarella, bet you didn't know you were part of a music show today, huh?
I did not, but I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, that's a good one. Todd Nelson, a local guitar player phenom for 40 some odd years. It's really good. Kaylee writes in, thanks for the show. Well, you're welcome. Would you talk about whether new information about reversing diabetes has a distinction between type 1 and type 2? And that's from Kaylee.
So when we talk about reversing diabetes, I think that conversation is about type 2 diabetes. When it comes to type 1, that autoimmune process causes permanent destruction of the pancreatic cells that make insulin. So once that process happens, unfortunately, there's no going back. That's something that we're looking into, and I look forward to the day when that is something that is reversible. But right now, if you have a diagnosis of type 1 diabetes, you have that for life, and you will be insulin dependent for life. So when it comes to type 2 diabetes, when someone is given the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, that's another thing that you do tend to keep that diagnosis, but you may be what we call diet controlled, which means you don't need medications to control your diabetes. There's a lot of people where that's the case. And so how you do that, how you can accomplish that is for those people who are overweight, losing weight has been shown to really substantially impact that insulin resistance that causes type 2 diabetes. There have been a lot of studies that have looked into this. And more than anything else, if you can successfully and lose a significant amount of weight, and by that I mean, 5% or more of your excess body weight, and maintain that, that can significantly improve your blood sugar levels.
So you're on board then with all these weight loss drugs that are everywhere on TV?
So that, I feel like we need another 1 to 5 or more hours probably to talk about just that topic. But in general, I will say I'm in favor of these medications. They were originally studied, and we still use them, I would say, primarily for treatment of type 2 diabetes. They work very effectively. And just to make it very clear what I'm talking about, the class of these drugs are called the GLP-1 receptor agonists. If you've read or looked at any news, you've probably heard about them. They work by increasing the production of insulin by your own pancreas, particularly at mealtimes when you consume sugar or carbohydrates. They also helped with weight loss by decreasing the appetite by affecting signaling in the brain and also slowing down the movement of food through the GI tract through the stomach so you get full more quickly. So you're full more quickly, you're less hungry, you eat less, and you lose weight. The medications in their ability to control blood sugar are very, very effective compared to some of the other options that are out there, and they don't cause weight gain, which is one of the concerns for some of the medications we use for type 2, since I just mentioned weight loss is a helpful thing for people with diabetes. So the combination for people with type 2 is a really effective treatment in most cases for most people. They are also now being FDA approved for use for just weight loss for people who are overweight without a diagnosis of diabetes. And they've been effective in that goal in most people. Not everyone is able to lose weight with these medications, but really important thing to know about them is they help you lose weight through those mechanisms. So while you take them, you may lose weight. A lot of people will experience a plateau effect. So over time, you may not lose any additional weight. And then if you stop taking the medication, the effect goes away and you are very likely to regain the weight unless you make significant lifestyle changes on top of the medication.
Our guest today is Dr. Pasquale Passarella, who is an endocrinologist at Albany Medical Center. And, okay, so type 1, you say it doesn't generally, it's not there when the baby is born. It takes a little while.
Right.
Any chance for a vaccine?
That's a very interesting thought. I wouldn't rule anything out. They certainly, I'd say, you know, at the forefront of medicine that's being studied and developed right now is you know, kind of gene therapy. If we can find a way to safely adjust certain genes that are known to cause disease, you know, we may be able to prevent or treat certain diseases. And so, you know, if we pinpoint genetic causes for type 1 diabetes, could we then come up with a gene therapy or a vaccine or something like that that could completely prevent diabetes from happening? I wouldn't rule it out and would look forward to something like that being developed.
So let's do that.
Sounds great.
All right. This is from, and there's no name here, but there's a shamrock. So thank you for that.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Okay. My daughter, mid-50s, says our writer, has thyroid nodules. They are checked periodically and her thyroid levels are within normal limits. No one in our family has had thyroid issues. What causes these and do they ever become problematic?
This is another thing we deal with quite a lot. So thank you for asking that question. Thyroid nodules are incredibly common. And what are thyroid nodules? So I often compare them to a mole you might find on your skin. So similar to a mole, a thyroid nodule looks different than the surrounding thyroid tissue. And in most cases, if you see a mole on your skin, it's a benign thing. It doesn't cause any problems. But there are some moles that just look a little bit suspicious. They're a little irregular, things like that. They're growing that probably need to be looked at and may even need to be biopsied or removed. The same thing is true about pretty much any lump or bump you find anywhere, but with thyroid nodules. So they are the result of the cells in the thyroid that make up the thyroid. Certain ones of them can develop these mutations as we age that cause them to start growing outside of the normal signals that control these things. And so they're growing and growing and growing just a little bit faster than the normal thyroid should. And so you get this growth, this solid bit of tissue that is inside the thyroid. So what can it do? If it grows too big, your neck's a pretty small area of real estate, so it can compress the nearby structures. So it can press on your windpipe, causing trouble breathing. It can press on your esophagus, the tube that food goes down, causing trouble swallowing. It can even compress the nerves that run right behind your thyroid that control the vocal cords, and so it can cause hoarseness or changes in your voice, weakening of your voice. So those are things to look out for if you have a growing, enlarged thyroid or a thyroid nodule. That's number one. Number two, and perhaps the most concerning with any sort of lump or bump you find, there is always the possibility that a thyroid nodule could potentially be thyroid cancer. Now, before doing any further investigation for any given thyroid nodule discovered by imaging or because you felt it in your neck, thankfully, statistically, it is unlikely to be thyroid cancer. Most thyroid nodules are benign, are non-cancerous. Only about, again, statistically, about 5 to 15% or so of these nodules end up being thyroid cancer.
That's still a pretty good number.
It's not zero, that's for sure, which is why if these things are discovered, they should be monitored. And depending on their appearance, their size, if they have suspicious features, things like calcifications, we may often recommend doing a biopsy, which is a procedure where we take a sample of that nodule, we look at it under a microscope, and we see if this could be thyroid cancer.
All right, let's go back to our phone lines here. Dr. Pasquale Passarella joins us today from Albany Med, and we'll go to Gilderland. Pete is up. Pete, go ahead.
Hello. Actually, two of the callers already asked my question, so I'll just expand it. I was going to ask about research that would eventually find a cure for type 1 and that kind of thing.
Okay.
So I guess I'm going to alter my question a little politically. With the present politics, do you fear problems with research funding?
All right. Thank you, Pete. What do you think, Doc?
Yeah, I mean, I wish things were different. There's no question if you're going to cut government funding for research, we're going to have less research to find new medications and treatments for diseases, which is a very, very unfortunate thing.
Let's go to Phoenicia and Robert. Robert, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I, too, had my first question answered about pancreatic transplant, so I'll ask a second one. My sister is a type 2 diabetic who has had a parathyroid removed and is also getting Prolia shots every 6 months. That's just some background. Her endocrinologist recently had her stop taking vitamin D3, which, as I understand it, helps absorb calcium. Yet he had her start taking Citracal, which has calcium. So I'm under the impression that she needs to stop taking the D3 because she has too much calcium, yet he has her taking additional calcium. She already takes 1,200 milligrams every morning. What am I getting wrong?
So it's a little hard to answer the question without having all the details in front of me, knowing the lab results and those sort of things. But why we might stop vitamin D, this is one of those situations where there is such thing as too much of a good thing, right? Vitamin D deficiency certainly causes problems. And as you rightly said, vitamin D is essential for absorption of calcium in your digestive tract from the calcium you're taking either from food or through a supplement. So if you don't have enough vitamin D, you're not going to absorb what you're eating or taking. But too much vitamin D can result in excessive absorption of calcium, can cause your calcium levels to become too high, and that can increase your risk of things like constipation, kidney stones, that of course we would want to avoid. So my guess would be the reason to stop vitamin D is that the levels were too high. We need, for those who have osteoporosis, which I'm assuming is the reason for the treatment with the Prolia, as that's a treatment for osteoporosis, you need to have enough calcium in your diet because that medication helps you to build bone, and you need the building blocks for calcium. So if she's not getting enough calcium from dietary sources, then she may need the supplementation. But again, without knowing the exact details of the lab results, I can't exactly tell you why one was stopped and one was started.
I happen to have her lab results in front of me, if there's anything I can answer.
Well, okay. We only have about another 30 seconds with you, Robert, so if you have one result that you'd like to talk about, do it. Otherwise, we'll move on, all right?
Is the doctor going to ask me which one?
Vitamin D, let's go for it.
Well, her most recent vitamin D was, I believe, 97, and the limit is 100.
Yeah, yeah. So if the vitamin D was ever over 100, that's generally the threshold where we will hold off on vitamin D for a while, because that's the danger zone where you're at an increased risk for those things like kidney stones and constipation
right.
And things.
He did have her stop the vitamin D for 30 days,
yeah,
and she has not yet started it again.
Yeah, so... vitamin D is primarily stored, it's a fat-soluble vitamin, so it's primarily stored in our fat tissue, and for that reason, the storage of vitamin D in the body is very, very prolonged, and it takes a longer time for your body's stores of vitamin D to decrease than for other vitamin Ds that are, other vitamins that are not fat-soluble. Okay. So it takes a long time of holding your vitamin D for the levels to get back down again.
Robert, thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it very much. Does that mean that obese people have less incidence of osteoporosis?
So, yes, but not for that reason. Your depot, your storage for vitamin D is bigger when you have more weight. That is correct. But because that is such a big storage to fill for people that carry excess weight, they actually have a greater tendency for vitamin D deficiency. And it takes more vitamin D to fill up the stores before the blood levels become adequate.
Interesting.
But people who are overweight, obese, may have a lower risk for osteoporosis because your weight
more
when you're standing.
More load-bearing exercises.
100%. Yes, exactly.
Oh,
you're bearing more weight, and weight-bearing stimulates bone
Genius.
Growth. It can help strengthen your bones.
All right. This is from Kelly. Kelly says, what can the good doctor tell us about surgically induced diabetes? Subject heading is type 3 diabetes. After having more than half of my pancreas removed, I came out of surgery unable to digest food with hypothyroid and risk for diabetes or pre-diabetic. I control it with food. Also had hormone plus breast cancer 3 times. I'm 55. Are these possibly related? Is the diabetes the prominent factor? And that's from Kelly.
So there's a lot to unpack
here.
Let's start with the diabetes. So if you get down to the nitty-gritty, scientists and doctors, we love to label things. And we are, as you may have guessed, not always creative about how we label things, because there'll be diabetes type 1, type 2.
Right.
But then you might see type 2B, 3C, things like that.
Right.
I prefer more descriptive terminology. So when it comes to like pancreatic surgery or pancreatic disease induced. Another term for that is pancreaticogenic diabetes. Some people may call it type 3, but yes.
Okay.
If you have your pancreas removed or if you have disease that is impacting your pancreas' ability to make insulin, then you become similar to someone who is type 1 diabetes because you're not making insulin. You need insulin treatment. But it also depends on how much of your pancreas is impacted. The body is really good at kind of maintaining stable things. And oftentimes you need to lose a very, very large portion of a certain gland or tissue for it to completely stop working, right? If you take out half your thyroid, just to jump to a different thing right now, in most cases, you're going to make enough thyroid hormone to maintain your levels.
Oh.
So if you take out only part of your pancreas, you won't necessarily develop diabetes, but you're certainly going to be higher risk for developing diabetes.
Interesting. Okay. Well, Tim in Clifton Park has been waiting just about a half an hour. So, Tim, you may be the last one. Maybe we'll get one more, but go ahead. It's all yours.
Sure. I'll try to make it quick. At one point, I had hyperthyroid, and then it went to hypothyroid. And then in the end, over the course of about a year, they said it was just thyroiditis. So my first question is, why would that happen, and how did it self-regulate, I guess? And then my follow-up question would be, as far as anxiety goes, where does the thyroid play a factor?
This is a great question. I like this. Thank you. So thyroiditis is one of the less common forms of hyperactive thyroid, too much thyroid hormone, or hyperthyroidism that we see out there. But it does happen for sure. We do see it. And so what it is, anytime you take any kind of tissue and add itis, I-T-I-S, to the end of it, it means inflammation. So this is thyroid inflammation. It is also autoimmune in its development. So it can happen after a recent illness, like a recent viral illness. If you had the flu or a cold or something like that, several weeks or months later, you may develop this autoimmune thyroiditis. So what happens? Your immune system gets activated and for some reason targets the thyroid tissue. It attacks the cells in the thyroid that produce and also store thyroid hormone. And so by damaging them, they're releasing all that thyroid hormone that's been stored there for later use all at once. So all of a sudden, your blood levels of thyroid hormone go through the roof and you become hyperthyroid. But this is in most cases, a time-limited process. Your body can heal. So the autoimmune inflammatory process goes away, the thyroid tissue heals, and so your thyroid hormone levels that were initially elevated, they decrease after the inflammation resolves. Depending on how much of your thyroid was damaged, it then may kind of, for a little while, not be able to make enough thyroid hormone, so your thyroid hormone levels might dip into the underactive phase, if that can last for a few weeks to a few months, and then at the end, your thyroid heals back up to normal, and your levels completely come back up to normal. So that whole process, usually the hyperactive phase lasts up to about 8 weeks or so. The hypothyroid phase can last 6 months or so. But usually the rule is within a year of onset, you come completely back to normal in most cases.
And that's what it was. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, we're going to have to leave it there, Tim, because we are out of time. But I'm glad we got you in after a half an hour waiting. Dr. Pasquale Passarella, that was a fast hour, man.
Yeah, flew right by.
You did very well.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Now, do you wear, in general, a bow tie to work, or do you just put the green one on for St. Patty's Day?
No, bow tie every single day.
Really?
Yes. There's a lot of reasons. Number one, of course, being style. But number two, when I'm leaning over to examine a patient, a regular tie will kind of dip into them and may spread infection. A bow tie does not do that.
Why don't you just wear no tie at all? Will they make you wear a tie?
No, nobody makes me wear a tie. I said, we'll refer back to point one, style.
All right, man. Hey, thanks for being on the show. Support comes from Dr. Humara S. Saida, Albany, announcing the new location of her OBGYN medical practice, 107A Everett Road, 518-808-4924. Well, thanks to everybody who called in. So many people didn't get in. So many emails I didn't get to. We'll do the topic again, and I appreciate your patience. We can only get them in as much as we have. If we had a four-hour show, as Dr. Passarella mentioned, well, we might have been able to do it. But I'm not doing that because Lucas Willard is waiting to do his show coming up in a half an hour. Thanks to Zach, our engineer. Thanks to Ed Rosen, who screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. It's almost spring. Tomorrow we talk weather with News Channel 13 meteorologist Reed Kisselback. We'll see you at 2:00.